This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
It's an honor to welcome back to the studio Richard Guy Wilson, architectural historian, prolific author, joins me live in studio to talk about the University of Virginia and the architecture of Thomas Jefferson. It's good to see you again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Let me ask you just to move up a little bit closer to that. How many classes do you have this semester?
Two plus a lot of theses.
Oh, yeah. You've got to work one-on-one with masters and...
BAs. We require BA and MA, and then I've got maybe four PhDs finishing.
This is busy enough. Yeah. Richard, the last time you were here, I think we talked about the fire at the university that gutted the rotunda. And the rebuilding effort after that, and what happened with the noted firm of Stanford Mead and White that went in and really remade the University of Virginia in many ways, and sort of ushered in the 20th century and this idea of new building and a new layout for the grounds, and Stanford White, who was in charge of that whole thing, really left his imprint on the university, did he not?
Yes, very definitely. Well, the firm was McKim Mead and White. And they had wanted to work here. Charlie McKim had visited the university in 1891 and was very impressed. And I should note that at this point in time, Jefferson's architectural reputation was nowhere. There was very, very little interest in Jefferson as an architect. Yeah, locally, he was known that he had something to do up at Monticello, but I mean, really... Well, there wasn't that much interest in American architecture, too, to be frank about. And the fire and that this very, very preeminent firm did this work here really helped to raise the status of the university and of Jefferson's architecture. And so White rebuilt, redesigned the rotunda, changed the entrance, a new north entrance, which there had never been one. Opened up the interior. There was instead of Jefferson, the way it is today, it was a continuous space, really, from the floor to the ceiling.
You walked in on the first floor and looked all the way up to the dome.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was because they needed space for books. Jefferson had designed it for about 10,000 books. And how could he know that they would have this explosion in book publishing that was going to be occurring? And so they really needed more book space. And then White did design the buildings for the south end of the lawn, Cabell, or today Old Cabell, Cock and Ross Hall. They are indicative, on one level, of changing education that had needed different sorts of spaces for education, and engineering laboratories, laboratories for science. We needed a public hall, which is Cabell Hall. And... So he actually didn't really want to put the buildings there.
At the south end of the lawn. Close it off, yeah.
Close it off. And there is a conversation of him with a friend in which this friend remarks, this is White back up in New York City, I've been down there and I'm scared to death. In other words, he was so impressed by what he saw. But... the rector of the university and the faculty wanted buildings there. And again, this gets into controversy and so forth. There have been a number of different attempts in the 19th century, putting a chapel, putting a 40-foot-tall statue of Jefferson, putting a huge memorial arch to the Confederacy down there. Something was going to happen. The second thing is, and now this gets very, very touchy, that right across JPA...
Canada, yeah.
...was an African-American village. And in a sense, it was blocking that off. So anyway, the buildings were put in, and you can say in a sense that what McKim, Mead, and White inaugurated here at the university, which went on most other American university campuses, is what might be called the Campus Beautiful. We had the City Beautiful, where we're redoing cities, putting in big boulevards, parks, and all of this. And the same sort of thing is going on in American campuses, trying to get them organized and spruced up and instead of all of this sort of hodgepodge going on in different places.
And this is a turn of the 20th century.
Yeah. And with us, I would argue that the Campus Beautiful – really continues until post-World War II. McKim, Mead, and White, they leave in March 1898. The buildings aren't dedicated until June 1898. And indeed, in the dedication ceremony of these buildings, McKim, Mead, and White are not mentioned.
Really?
Because they had had a big falling out with the university over the management of the project. And the university had absolutely no method of handling things. They had a rector. They had the head of the faculty senate. That was it. Administration, Jefferson, believer in small government. So you had absolutely no way to handle this. And there was just constant problems. I could go through this. I mean, bricks, materials. They ran out of money. There was supposed to have been a dome over Old Cabell Hall. They didn't have the money for that. They're supposed to have marble steps in the rotunda. Ran out of money for that, so they were concrete. The marble steps and rotunda now were not put on until 1939. So anyway, they left. But what happened, and you can say that out of ashes grow hope, is that the Board of Visitors did recognize that the university had to get on with the changes that were going on in American higher education, the move towards the a strong chief executive officer, a president. So what they did was in 1904, Edwin Alderman was appointed the president. And this is a change that had been going on in American universities beginning in the 1870s with Harvard, later on with other universities. We were laggards in this. Alderman came, and what he wanted, and it's interesting, he hired McKim, Mead, and White back again. They came back, and they were very glad. In the middle of this second campaign, which is Carr's Hill and Garrett Hall, and there were supposed to be other buildings, but they weren't built. Stanford White, as you may know, this notorious, he was a womanizer. He was shot on the roof garden of the old Madison Square Garden, which is, incidentally, a building that he and his firm had designed by the husband of a former lover of his, Evelyn Nesbitt. And it set off the yellow paper wars, and Hearst and Pulitzer trying to outdo each other with, you know, scandals. We've had novels written on it. E.L. Doctorow's Ragtime is one of the better known. Several movies done. Norman Mailer played Stanford White in the movie version.
We're talking with architectural historian Richard Guy Wilson. He's live in studio, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Richard, when Stanford White came in to rebuild the university after the rotunda, was there, up until then, throughout most of the 19th century, the architecture had not been classical. You could look at some of the additions to the academical village itself on some of the range buildings and the hotels. You can see that they sort of responded to the classical themes. But it was, Brooks Hall and the chapel, and these were Victorian, sort of very different Gothic kinds of things. When they came in, did they just assume from the beginning, we are doing a classical Jeffersonian architecture here? We're not going to try something modern or...
Well, I mean, Kim, Mead, and White are the preeminent, I would say, classical firm at the turn of the century. They reintroduce classicism. Now, there are other firms involved in this, but they are a big New York firm, and they are very, very important in reintroducing what I call the American Renaissance. It was actually a term that was used then, that we're going to go back to the founding. We're going to go back to those classical roots that founded American architecture, such as Jefferson or Bulfinch or whoever you want, and we are going to reassert that. And so there was never any question in their mind. Brooks is a wonderful building. I'm glad we have it.
And that's Brooks Hall.
Brooks Hall.
Originally a natural history museum across from the corner there.
Right. And the chapel is a wonderful Victorian Gothic building. And indeed, if they'd had their way, they would have come down, too. Well, that's me saying, but I would suspect.
I read somewhere recently that the university really didn't have much say in either one of those buildings because Brooks was a gift from, Lewis Henry Brooks, a northern financier, and the chapel was an effort on the part of a ladies' group here in the university area to raise money and build what they wanted to put at the university.
Well, yes. Of course, you have to keep in mind that... In architecture, architectural history as in history, change occurs. If you don't have change, you don't have a history. I mean, I know that sounds simplistic, but there had been a huge revolution in American ecclesiastical or church architecture in the 19th century towards the Gothic or the medieval types of styles. And the chapel that was designed by a university alumnus. He went here in an engineering school who did the building. And was in the Confederate cavalry, and then he winds up in Baltimore as an architect there, and he's hired to come back and to do it. But to show you the meanings on this, when that was dedicated, there was a ceremony that was held out there, and one of the speakers was a professor of modern language by the name of Maximilian de Vere. And Maximilian de Vere, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, "In back of us rises the dome of paganism. In front of us rises the arches of Christianity." And this is the type of association that these buildings could hold.
So the rotunda was the dome of paganism,
right?
Jefferson's paganism.
Yes.
And that God had finally come to the University of Virginia. Is that the message?
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, that was one of the things throughout the 19th century. There was a lot of concern that basically that what they were doing up in Charlottesville was raising a bunch of heathens up here, you know, without the – because every institution of higher learning had a religious component to it.
Yeah.
And we were just the oddballs.
Yeah, the odd man out here. We're talking with Richard Guy Wilson of the University of Virginia, architectural historian. What let's do now, Richard, is let's move into the 20th century and talk about some of the notable developments throughout the 20th century. It would appear that commitment that McKim, Mead, and White brought to rebuilding the rotunda after the fire of 1895, this classical, the foundations of Jeffersonian, what we think of now as Jeffersonian architecture, that became the dominant theme, and still is in many ways.
Right, and very definitely it did. I would say that the significant events after McKim, Mead, and White was first a man by the name of William Lambeth. Lambeth Field is named for him. And he actually wrote the first book on Jefferson's architecture. And Lambeth was involved in a variety of different projects. But then what really is important was in 1919, McIntyre gave money for the founding of a school of fine arts, which we had not had, because fine arts at a men's school, well, you got to be a little careful on that. And McIntyre gave money for a school of fine arts, and they hired as the director of it an architect by the name of Fisk Kimball. And Fisk Kimball had also written a book on Jefferson's architecture. And not to denigrate Lambeth, but Kimball's was probably the more important one. And so Kimball came, and he was the director of the McIntyre School of Fine Arts for about 5 years, 4.5 years. And while he leaves to ultimately wind up at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, still he keeps his finger here in town. He's on the board at Monticello. He's very much involved in the restorations of Monticello. He builds his own house just outside of town here. He's constantly involved in things at the university. And under Kimball, we get not only a school of architecture, which is very much in a classical mode set up that way. He does the amphitheater. He is part of MEM Gym, Memorial Gymnasium. He does the university apartments. It's just across the bridge on Rugby Road. And he carries on the McKim thing. And from him, then you get a host of other architects coming in. But Kimball's always there in the background.
Oh, is he?
Always there in the background a little bit. And so that continues. And so that we do get a very impressive set of buildings, so whether it's Alderman Library, the original Monroe Hall, the dormitories, all of this stuff, the engineering building, Thornton Hall. Those are all part of this sort of university beautiful.
And all of which, the architecture of all of them, speak back to the academical village.
All
you can see
back,
those
yes,
themes.
Yes, they all speak back to it. They're bigger buildings, of course, and But the red brick, white trim, classical details, very frequently in U types of shapes, courtyards, this type of thing. And Peabody Hall, which is the original school of engineering, it's all part of this whole thing. And that continues and is very, very, very dominant until post-World War II. And but what happens is that in the – well, and indeed it is interesting. For instance, New Cabell Hall and Newcomb Hall, those are post-World War II. Those are designed by a New York firm by the name of Eggers and Higgins, which is not going to mean much to many people, but they were the successor firm to John Russell Pope. What did John Russell Pope do? The Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., the National Gallery, the National Archives building. Well, if you do the Jefferson Memorial, you can be, excuse me, darn sure you're going to wind up at the University of Virginia, you see. But I think that it's safe to say that in the beginning of the later 1950s, there were big changes going on elsewhere in American architecture. And so we begin to go in that direction, and modernism becomes.
And begin to move away from the look of the academical village.
Right, right.
Let's take a break for local news and weather. And when we get back, let's pick up there with some of those things on grounds and how the university changed after the war and the modernism that we see in some of the architecture. Right. And then the sort of the rebirth of these classical elements within the past 20 or 30 years. And then we'll look forward to South Lawn and beyond. Right. We're honored to be talking with architectural historian Richard Guy Wilson. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now, News Radio 1070 WINA.
We're doing a dance that can't be beat. We barefootin'.
Let's rejoin our conversation with Richard Guy Wilson, architectural historian at the University of Virginia, the author of many books about the history of UVA and architecture, and also you were the curator for an exhibit that's at Special Collections, and I actually walked by it today and just saw it again today. I was over there during lunch, and strongly recommend that folks check it out because so much of what we have talked about is on exhibit there, and you can see the photographs and the original drawings and read about these changes that have taken place at the University of Virginia over time in the built environment and what that says about the culture and the vision and what's going on at that time. Richard, let's pick up with the post-World War II era, which sort of is a transitional period from what had existed since the fire of 1895, and where you see one big building after another with big white columns, to something very different.
Well, what happens is, of course, in post-World War II years is a tremendous growth in the size of the university. And what I would say, we become campus suburban. We're not alone. This happens at many other institutions and so forth. But there's tremendous growth, need a lot more space for things. And there is also, we've got the automobile. Now, we'd had automobiles before, but now
nothing like this. Yeah.
Nothing like this. And so there is this beginning of this spread. And so the university begins to spread out much more down over to the west and to the southwest. And then ultimately North Grounds and, over at the sports complex and then finally to North Grounds. And this is really a very, very dramatic shift. And along with this comes the new architecture. And the university is very keen to try and continue to hire good architects. They'd had McKim, Mead, and White. They'd had Fisk Kimball. They'd had good people. And indeed, if you go down the line and look at the individuals who are involved, such as Stanford Anderson on the old U Hall, these were leading architects at the time, or Pietro Belushki and Sasaki, Dawson, and DeMay. They did Campbell Hall, which is the architecture school building. And indeed, if you do look at these, I think you can see that these architects are, to some degree, trying to reference what Jefferson did, but in a much more modern language. Now, of course, that language now is 40 and 50 years old
right,
for
right.
us. But
yeah, some of those modern buildings to us now in 2010, they're not very pretty, and they look sort of like, oh, that's just some old building, and you don't get the same feel from something from the 50s or the 60s or even the 70s that we get from those big buildings with white columns.
No, right. And but as I'm saying, I do think that there was very much this attempt to try and reference it. The law, originally the law in the business school up in North Grounds, was two parallel rows. But there was a reaction that set in. And how to term this reaction, the term that's sometimes used is postmodernism or POMO. And it is that modernism is challenged, these much more abstract, and this is not just here, this happens nationwide. And there is part of also feeding into this is an interest in historic preservation. And while we are very conscious today, I think, of historic preservation, you have to keep in mind that, yes, there had been attempts. They'd saved Mount Vernon. Yes, in the 1920s, Monticello. But still, the idea of a much broader than just the founding fathers type of a thing is really very much a post-World War II phenomenon. And so historic preservation feeds into this. And so you do get architects, and we hire architects such as Robert A. M. Stern to do initially an addition to the Observatory Hill Dining Hall. And this was a building that was very abstractly modern with shed roofs that went off in all different directions. I don't think anybody ever liked it very well. and Stern sort of covered it up with some columns and some things around it. And now it's no longer there because we tore it down a couple of years ago. The Darden School decides to build their own grounds, and that's Stern that does that, the Darden School. They move out of the quad that they were in into a new one. And so we do get what I would say is a new history, a historical type of campus. Now, the problem with this is that is all you got to do, build a brick box and put some white columns on it, and that takes care of the problem. And in this case, I'm thinking about the John Paul Jones, the arena there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that is... What is the point?
Is that what we've gotten to, where you can just throw a colonnade on a brick box, and it's Jeffersonian and appropriate architecture at the University of Virginia? You've tipped your hat to the academical village, and that's enough.
And so there is that. Though alternatively, the Washington, D.C. firm of Hartman Cox, a very eminent firm, they did the additions to Monroe Hall. They did the new special collections. They just did the new addition to Cox for the McIntyre School.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the philosophy that has evolved now in the past 20-odd years is that the closer we are to the center, to the lawn, the more there needs to be a respect that is paid to that. But that the farther away you go, the more that you maybe can experiment with some other sorts of things.
Yeah. I guess the exception to that would be the new Darden School, which is probably one of the furthest buildings away from the academical village, and yet looks most like it, you know, in terms of layout and design.
Right. Yes, it is. And Robert Stern, Robert A.M. Stern, who did it, it was very much in that mode. At the same time, it is, and if one wants to be critical about it, his attempt at the lawn side there is not, I think, all that successful. It's just the same thing repeated over and over. But it does show, and
it's a bit over the top, isn't it? I mean, when you approach that building, it's like, come on. I mean, it's so over the top with its classical, it sort of hits you in the face with it instead of what you could say about the academical village. Almost, it's very subtle in its classicism.
Right. Yes, and I think that that's very true. The one thing is that I guess I've learned as a historian over the years is that attitudes can change. Buildings age. And while, as you say, right now, those 50s and 60s modernist boxes, look sort of old, they're actually becoming historical. We are thinking about now beginning to restore them. They are part of our history, and architecture as many eminent individuals have said, that architecture is really the sort of the permanent record of mankind. And so they are parts of a history here that...
Yeah. We're talking with architectural historian Richard Guy Wilson about the University of Virginia. What are your thoughts now about the university tearing down some of those modern dorms that are being built and rebuilding new ones? And what's going to happen now as the university looks to the 21st century?
Well, certainly some of the dorms need badly to be replaced. And I would go on record as saying that I think that one of the failings of the university is that we have not housed more of our students. That I think housing of students and providing environments in which is a community is a very important part of education and of higher education. And now I think we house somewhere, it's basically the first years is what we house, and then there's some other sorts of things. But I think that it's a very, very important thing of housing. And those dorms just weren't very satisfactory, and we need to upgrade them. And so I am all in favor. I mean, I don't think that any of the dorms that are being destroyed are that important. I'm more concerned about buildings such as Cabell Hall, Campbell Hall, a couple of those types of buildings, which were very eminent architects. There was a lot of energy put into it. We also hired some other very good architects whose buildings never got built. For instance, Lou Kahn, who is one of the stars. He was designed a chemistry building, but politics got in the way and it never happened.
Do you think we might see, when it comes to dormitories, what you see at so many other universities? You just drive over the mountain and you go up to Harrisonburg and you see these 9-10-story dormitory buildings. Are we going to see that kind of thing at UVA, you think, in this century?
We're probably going to see some taller buildings. I mean, one of the concerns with campus suburban, we spread out. The core of the place is the lawn, and it's trying to bring the students in there. And one of the sad things with the lawn is that there's very few classes that are being offered there. There is a campaign underway to put some classes back into the rotunda and into those wings on either side.
Fantastic.
Which I think is essential.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I have students who've never been in the rotunda. They're graduating and they've never been in the rotunda.
My God.
Okay. I mean, I know you and me, we're historians.
Yeah,
we can't believe that. But
that has gotten normal and has gotten okay to the people in charge. To me, it's horrible.
Well, no, that's what we're trying to correct here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that we need to make the Jefferson core isn't just a little historical village or just the rotunda becomes a sort of the image of the
university. It becomes a postcard,
a postcard. It's not just a digital recreation, that it's a real living element.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, that's one thing I really appreciated when I was at the William & Mary. I loved the fact that the two of the classes I took were in the Wren building. I loved that. Yeah. I loved being able to go to class in that building and that they still hold classes there and that tourists would open the door and peek in every single time we had class. I liked that,
No, and so that's what I think is to say that is going on. I mean, as far as the future of the university is that we are going to get buildings, maybe even go down a little bit, but trying to keep inward focus rather than continuing the sprawl type of a thing. I mean, we do have our research parks and all of that, and that's fine.
So universities might be doing what cities and counties are now trying to do, this infill idea let's work with the space that we have instead of moving too far away from the center.
Right.
So more infill and also a rediscovery of the center and getting more students back to the lawn.
Yeah.
And that's not going to be easy.
No, but I think it is very possible to do. And there's been studies that are done. David Newman, who's a university architect, has done some they've done some studies on this and so forth. And that we can fill in a lot more than we have been doing and so forth. The solution is not taking the bus or the car out to bring things in.
Yeah. It reminds me that when the university had Birdwood for so many years, the plan, I think it began in the 60s, was the Birdwood, which is now a golf course, was going to be a whole bunch of dorms.
Right.
And the students were going to live out there.
Yes.
It was never popular with the students and the people who really appreciated what right. this university was always about,
yeah.
always recognized that as a crazy idea.
Yeah. No, and exactly the same thing, if you remember a few years ago in the medical school and the hospital, and they were going to move the hospital out on Route 20 there across from where you turn to go up to Monticello.
Yeah.
They were going to stick it out there.
Through the old sanitarium out
yes,
there.
Yes,
yeah.
And have the medical school still at the university. Well, I mean, the medical school and the hospital are joined at the hip.
Yeah, yeah.
You understand, and this was just a crazy sort of an idea. And so,
what are your thoughts about the South Lawn project? Can you give us your ideas about that? Because that is officially
right.
open for
right.
business. They're holding classes there. Professors have moved yeah. in, and it's very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, been a long time in the works.
Right. It's been a long time in the works and went through a number of different designs and different architects. I think that it looks very successful so far. It's not fully completed yet, but certainly the intention is to take, in a sense, the concept of Jefferson's idea of an open space with classrooms that surround it, and to continue it on over. And then there will be an auditorium in the center, and there will be a sort of a student gathering place and all of that. And faculty I know who have moved into offices are very praiseworthy of it, and it looks like it has. We finally got something doing there after well, I don't know, a couple of decades.
How many meetings did you go to for that?
Oh, well.
Richard Guy Wilson is live in studio, architectural historian, the author of many books, including Thomas Jefferson's Academical Village, and the curator of an exhibit now going on at Special Collections Library at the University of Virginia. That's the building right there next to Alderman Library. And you can see pictures and drawings of everything that we've talked about in this hour, the complete history from the fire on, I guess. Well, you actually began in the mid-19th
century.
Well,
we begin with Jefferson.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's what happened to the university after Jefferson. There is a history.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop with Jefferson.
And it's really quite fascinating. Richard, thank you so much for being here. Always look forward to talking with you, and we'll get you back again soon. We'll take a quick break. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.